Welcome, everybody, to our NEA BPD podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Gold, and tonight's podcast will be an interview with Dr. Shireen Rizvi. There are no handouts for this podcast, just audio. And we'll be chatting about the topic of her first book, which is titled Chain Analysis in Dialectical Behavior Therapy, or DBT. I just want to do a brief introduction with Shireen's background, and then we'll get started with our conversation. So she completed her doctoral training in clinical psychology at the University of Washington, where she studied borderline personality disorder and DBT with her mentor, who's the founder of DBT, Dr. Marsha Linehan. In 2009, Shireen became faculty at the Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology at Rutgers University, where she is currently an assistant professor. She's the director of the DBT Clinic at Rutgers, which is a research and training clinic for individuals with borderline personality disorder and associated problems. In addition to Shireen's incredibly high quality and expert work as a DBT psychologist, trainer, researcher, and professor, she's recently added book author to her list of important and impressive accomplishments. So it's a real treat that we get to talk with you, Shireen, about your recent book. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Such a lovely introduction. I'm really happy to be here talking with you all, and I am tickled when I hear you say my first book, as though there will be many others. It may be the only book. We shall see.
Well, it's a great spot because it's really a topic where clinicians, I think, do a lot of important work with their clients and could use help from an expert like you. So let's start at the beginning with the title of your book. And I'm wondering if you could give us the TLDR version of what in the world it's chain analysis is. And for people who don't know, TLDR is internet speak for too long, didn't read. So what is a chain?
So this is the question that I have to answer for any one of my relatives who is so excited to hear that I wrote a book and then picks it up and has no idea even what the title means. So I will say that, for people that are on the call that are familiar with dialectical behavior therapy or DBT, they know what a chain analysis is, hopefully. But everybody else, I'll just explain that chain analysis is essentially the method or the main assessment strategy in DBT that's used to identify the sequence of events or links that lead up to a problem behavior or a target behavior and treatment, as well as the consequences. And the idea is that if we learn how to assess in this very specific and detailed way, we are going to be best able to intervene. That is, if we really understand the problem in its minutiae, that's going to give us the best information that we can have in order to change the series of events in the future so that the target behavior no longer occurs. Was that too esoteric? Can I break it down?
Well, I thought that was a really good TLDR because you explained your book pretty quickly, considering there's a lot there. I'm wondering if you could give even a more simplistic explanation, kind of in a nutshell, how you'd explain it to a relative who knows absolutely nothing about chains or DBT.
Yeah, I would say in a nutshell, when people come into treatment, they're looking essentially to change things about their lives. And in DBT specifically, they're looking to change, or at least in DBT, the way we frame it is that what they're looking to change in their lives are behaviors that they want to do less and behaviors that they want to do more. So behaviors to increase and behaviors to decrease become kind of the targets of treatment. So in the case of DBT, for example, a common treatment target is to address self-injury. And so we would say in behavioral language, what we aim to do in treatment is decrease self-injurious behaviors. In order to do that, we have to really understand the behavior. At least that's the behavioral frame. We have to really understand the behavior. And in order to understand the behavior, we need a method for assessing it. And that's what the chain analysis is in DBT. And it's called chain analysis because it's as though you're imagining, a chain of links. And what we're trying to figure out is what were all the links that led up to occurrence of a target behavior, so that we can figure out how to break apart those links so that that target behavior is less likely to occur in the future.
Wow, we give our speakers this huge and daunting task to speak to this range, this huge audience. We ask you to tailor your talks to therapists, researchers, consumers, family members, and I think this explanation really nailed it for us. So along those lines, I'm wondering if you were to give the same overview, but if you were talking to a therapist or one of your mm-hmm. students who's training to be a therapist, are there any things you would say differently?
You know, I'm not sure I would say it much differently, to be honest with you. You know, we often talk about DBT as being a transparent treatment, you know, in a mm-hmm. sense that anything the therapist knows or is doing is something that we feel like is totally accessible to the clients as well. And so, you know, I don't think I speak, I wouldn't necessarily speak to family members versus therapists versus clients in any different way. Probably the only way I would change my language is depending on, you know, the education level of the person I'm talking mm-hmm. to and whether they can understand what I'm saying, you know, at a high level, or whether I need to, you know, break down the concepts even further. But mm-hmm. But essentially, you know, what I said earlier is the same thing that I would say to a therapist or student, as well as to a consumer or a client.
I think that's a really important point you're making about DBT in general, you know, clearly how you're applying it to teaching about chain analysis, but also in general. Is that something that you find to be particularly helpful when working with people with borderline personality disorder, this aspect of being transparent?
Well, I think for me, you know, I learned the treatment from Marsha Linehan, and so I would say every type of treatment and every therapeutic intervention I do is informed by my training in DBT. So I can't speak to whether I think, you know, I can't speak to whether I found it to be more helpful with people with BPD compared to another population because I just do it with everyone.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I will say, you know, I've had many instances, and I remember watching videos of Marsha Linehan in the same way, where clients would come in and say, oh, I read your book about, you know, I read that DBT book. And at first, you're kind of filled with a little bit of horror. Oh, no. Like, what does that mean? They've read this book. But then you realize it's a huge blessing, you know, and it's exactly consistent with the treatment mm-hmm. to say, that's great. You know, now you can tell me when I'm not doing DBT and I can work on being shaped up. And I have no expectations whatsoever that there will be clients out there reading a book on chain analysis. But if they were to, or family members, but if they were to, I would say this is also wonderful because, you know, the more transparent the treatment is, the more transparent the methods are, I think my hypothesis is that that's going to make the treatment more effective.
So when you're getting ready to start therapy with a client and introducing chains, let's mm-hmm. talk about that and let's hear how you introduce chains to your clients. You actually have a whole chapter about this in your book. For those listening, the name of this chapter is Guidelines for Client Orientation and Collaboration for Chain Analyses. So I'm wondering, you know, about the orientation process and how you make this collaborative.
Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect to doing chains. So if I wanted to talk with someone, and I think this is something that gets in the way for a lot of people. So if I wanted to talk to someone in treatment, a client in treatment, about a recent episode of, let's say, substance use as their target behavior, then early in treatment, I don't know the client well, or I hardly know the client at all. And so in the first time you do a chain analysis with a client, you're really getting to know so many things about the person. It's not just about this one episode because you're also learning about how they generally do things by examining this one episode. And I think that the first time you do a chain analysis really sets up both the client and the therapist expectations for future times doing chain. So I think orienting to the process and making sure that it's a collaborative one is a really important aspect to the first time you do a chain analysis. So, Andrea, if I were to talk to you about this, let's say you're my client, if you don't mind, the way I might frame it is to say, you know, Andrea, you came into treatment because you're interested in reducing your substance use, and I think that I could be really helpful to you in that area. And one of the ways that will increase my ability to help you is to really understand what your substance abuse behavior looks like. And so for that, what I want to do is narrow in on a recent episode, perhaps your most recent episode of substance use. And what I want you to do is tell me the sequence of events that led up to you using, as well as any immediate consequences. And I want to do this so that you and I both get as much information as possible. And if we have a whiteboard in the therapy room, then we're going to use that so that we can kind of map it out together, because I really want you and I to see this in exactly the same way.
So how early in therapy, like what session number would you start this conversation?
So there's not any specific rule about, you know, what session number. I think there's a number of tasks that a DBT therapist is doing in the first few sessions of DBT. So there's no rule that says, you know, you must introduce the client to chain analysis in session 2 or session 4, that sort of thing. However, I think it's often likely that you would do a chain, you know, within the first few sessions of DBT. And this is especially true, I think, if somebody comes in with a high severity behavior, like suicidal behavior, or has recently made a suicide attempt, and that's what brought them into treatment, or they're at risk of suicide, because that's going to, you know, help you get a sense of what was it that led up to that suicide attempt, so you can also understand risk. But with other clients, you know, maybe they came in because they want help with substance use behavior, but their substance use behavior is intermittent, and so it could be a couple of weeks before you get to really diving in deep about a particular episode of substance use. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So you brought up the example of how you would do this especially early if we're talking about life-threatening behaviors like suicidality or self-harm. I'm wondering if you could speak to the role of these early chain analyses, especially when you're introducing them as assessment tools versus intervention tools. And I know that those are related, but I can imagine clinicians listening often want to help with some risk management and get a plan in place. And so I'm wondering how you balance that with orienting and making it collaborative and assessing safety and risk management.
Yeah, so it's a lot to balance. And I think this is the sort of thing that makes, you know, therapists, especially novice therapists, very nervous about, you know, trying to figure out how am I going to balance all of these things together. And so one of the things that I want to say about chain analysis is that I think it's really important for therapists, I'm using the word therapist, but, you know, clinicians or whatever term people find most useful. But for me, it's easier to say therapist. But what is really essential for therapists to keep in mind about this is that chain analyses are in the service of helping the client change their behavior in meaningful ways. So it's not meant to be a chore, nor is it meant to be something that the therapist, you know, crosses off their checklist. Oh, it says I have to do a chain analysis, but I'm doing a chain analysis today. It's really like this is the tool for the therapist. And so I say all that because I really want the therapist to see this as an opportunity to really get to know the behavior and also get to know the person, of course, in this context. And because really critically understanding the behavior is what's going to facilitate the most effective solutions. I think many therapists, especially early on in treatment or early on in their own training, might see somebody who comes in with a particular problem. And because the therapist is so desperate and eager to help, what they do is they just throw out solution after solution. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, have you tried this? Or, you know, in the case of substance use, you know, you just need to go to more meetings, or, you know, you just need to stop hanging out with so-and-so, or you need to get rid of all this stuff in your house. And all of those things might actually be reasonable solutions. However, without really understanding the problem and the ideographic ways in which the problem exists for this person, we're also running the risk of offering solutions that are not going to work. And I think what I would argue is that when you offer solutions that don't end up working, the client loses faith in the treatment, right? Whether they are thinking it explicitly or not, because that's learning, right? They learn, oh, this thing that my therapist suggested doesn't work at changing this behavior. And so that makes me think that actually what's going to be more effective in the long run is asking and assessing more before jumping in and rushing into solutions, because you really want to make sure that by the time you offer solutions, the solutions you're offering are the ones that are most likely to change the behavior. And I think where you might get therapists saying, oh, but I can't always do that, is especially in the area of high risk situations, because it is absolutely true that with some clients who are very high risk, you don't have a lot of time to assess. And so with those situations, when they're highly suicidal or you fear that there might be imminent suicide, you might have to offer some solutions even without fully assessing, because you don't have the luxury of time in those situations.
So you made the point that jumping in with solutions without a careful assessment could lead the client to not trust the relationship. I also can imagine that doing that could make the client feel invalidated in the moment and make it harder to do the change.
I think that's a good point, too. I mean, how many of us have, you know, talked to friends or family members about a problem and the person says, oh, just do such and such, you know, as though it was a simple problem to change. And I know that when that happens to me, I get really irritated and am unlikely to do whatever it is that they just, you know, flippantly told me to do. So I think you're right. I think that it could interfere in that way as well.
So moving along the chapters in your book, after orientation and collaboration, you have a chapter on assessing a problem for the first time. So are there mm-hmm. any specific tips you'd like to share with our audience on that point that you think often get missed when people do chains?
Yeah, so I, you know, this is one of these things that it's funny to me now, but at the time I was kind of embarrassed by it, that I had been learning DBT for several months in Marsha Linehan's lab. And, you know, for people that are listening in that are DBT therapists, they'll recognize what this means. But, you know, in DBT, we use these tools called diary cards, where the client fills out a card every day that essentially is a list of behaviors that are relevant for treatment, and they have to write whether they engaged in the behavior or not on that day, as well as, you know, other experiences they had every day. And that diary card becomes the tool that the therapist uses in any given session to kind of let you know where things stand for the client in the past week or since you last saw them. And it took me way too long, looking back, to have this light bulb go on over my head to realize that the diary card indicates to me which of the target behaviors were present in the past week, hopefully, and of that list, you know, what are my top most priority behaviors. And what the light bulb did for me was tell me, oh, I'm supposed to do a chain analysis on whatever it is that's my topmost target of treatment if it happened in the past week. For some reason, I did not realize that for a really long time. And perhaps it's obvious to every single person who's on this phone call right now, in which case you're way ahead of the game. So congratulations. And I don't even remember why I started talking about this. What were you asking me?
Assessing a problem for the first time. What do we need to know?
Thank you. Okay. So that, you know, that when you're starting in treatment with someone, you're going to be assessing their topmost target for the first time. But it might also happen later in therapy with someone when actually a new target behavior shows up. And maybe this is because you've addressed the higher order targets, or maybe a person started engaging in a new behavior that's a problem. And so assessing a behavior for the first time isn't something that just happens in the first few sessions. It could happen at any time during treatment. So that's kind of the first point, is that that kind of thorough assessment on a behavior for the first time doesn't only happen in the first few sessions.
You're making a really important point, too, not only specific to chain analysis, but in general, assessment isn't something that just happens in the beginning of treatment. It's ongoing.
Exactly. And I think that's where my story was supposed to go, if I had remembered to put the links together myself. Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that that's another thing that might be a little bit different than other treatments, certainly other behavioral treatments. I think that, you know, anybody else who's been trained on other manuals, you know, short-term manuals to address a particular problem or diagnosis, was probably trained in a manual that dedicated a certain number of sessions at the beginning for assessment and understanding. And then it was kind of the idea that once you've done this, you know, assessment, now you can move into the treatment. And instead, in DBT, assessment and treatment are constantly intertwined because assessment is happening throughout treatment when a new behavior shows up or a new target shows up. But assessment also continues to happen throughout treatment when previous solutions are not working the way you expect them to. That requires a therapist to go back to the drawing board and say, what is it that I've missed? How do I assess, how do I understand this problem better? Because I'm clearly missing something if the behavior isn't changing, and that's an assessment issue. That will bring you back to chain analysis again.
So you brought up the point of what if the chains aren't working? So what do you do if the behavior that your client wants to change and that you're trying to help that person change isn't changing? Do you just keep on doing chains forever?
No, not chains forever. In a sense, yes, you do keep assessing. So I'll kind of reframe it that way. If a behavior is not changing and you've assessed it before and come up with a solution based on your prior assessment, if the behavior isn't changing, you have to ask yourself a couple of different questions. One is, did I find the effective solution, but the client isn't engaging in the solution, right? So let's say you have discovered that in order to change the self-injury behavior, an effective solution would be for the client to engage in particular emotion regulation strategies when they find that their urges are going up. And let's say you decide that they should use the TIP skills from DBT, which stands for things like changing your which includes things for changing your body chemistry so as to get your urges to go down. So it could be that that solution would be highly effective, but the person isn't using them. That's one problem. But another problem could be that actually the client does use the TIP skills, but they don't work. They don't reduce the urges, and the client ends up self-injuring anyway. In that latter case, what you might think of as a therapist is maybe that solution actually isn't targeting the right link in a chain. Maybe we need to find a solution that intervenes earlier, for example. Or maybe we need to do something that affects the prompting event. You know, what is it that set the person down the chain to self-injure? Or maybe I need to intervene somewhere else in terms of maybe it's consequences. Maybe the person, you know, has something happen immediately after they self-injure, and that something that happens, it reinforces the behavior and makes it more likely that, for it to keep going. So when a solution doesn't work, what you want from a therapist's frame of mind is to think, okay, what have I missed? Is it that the solution I have suggested is too difficult to do, or the person didn't commit to doing it, or is the solution I suggested not the most effective one based on this behavior and I need to assess more? Sometimes when you continue to assess, you know, this idea of like, do I need to do chains forever? Like, I think that hopefully they're not seen as a chore, but also I have found, and I'm sure many therapists have had this experience, where the first time you ask somebody about something, you actually don't hear all the details about it. And it's not necessarily the case that the client is purposely holding back something. You know, it could be that something is out of their awareness, and it's not until you continue to, you know, zero in on particular instances that something that actually is quite relevant comes into the client's awareness and they share it, right? Then there's other times where, because of deep shame or embarrassment, the client doesn't tell you about something that's actually a really important link in the chain. And it's only by assessing, you know, more than once, or continuing to assess and saying, what am I missing? You know, this doesn't quite add up to me, or I'm missing something important here, that the client may finally say, yes, there's something else that I haven't been telling you. And so continued assessment, I just think, is really valuable. And I think it should be understood as also necessary. Like, I can't tell you, because it's been fewer than, you know, a handful of times where I've assessed a problem once and the problem was solved. It just usually doesn't happen that way. Human behavior is complex, and we don't always know what all the variables are that are controlling our behavior. And so it usually takes repeated assessment.
Well, and another thing you're alluding to is this idea that people can get stuck in mood dependency, where what they say or what they remember or what they do depends on the mood they're in. And so if you can assess at different points in time, that may be something you could target as well.
I think that's a really important factor. I think also, you know, length of time since the behavior occurred is an important factor. You know, if I see my clients on Monday and they're describing something that happened last night, that's very different than describing something that happened 6 days ago, because most people can't remember, you know, that level of detail as days go on. So I think you're exactly right about mood dependency, but there's all sorts of contextual variables that affect, you know, what we do or don't disclose about a behavior.
So you mentioned, you brought the word chore, and chains can sometimes come across that way. And some people, you also mentioned shame, and so people who, either with or without, even individuals without borderline personality disorder, may struggle with shame and intense shame and experience chains as punishing. So I want to hear you speak to that, and also hearing ways to do chains that may help reduce shame and ideally improve the therapy relationship.
Yeah, there's so much there. So in that question, so I hope you hold on to all the different parts in case I don't.
I'm with you.
Answer them. Okay, thank you. So the issue of people experiencing chains is punishing, and I think that sometimes therapists feel this way too, so it's not just clients that we're talking about. It always makes me a little sad when people find them punishing because, you know, I think they're so important and valuable. And so that's one thing. Like, if a client were to say to me, I hate them. Why are you making me do them? My first response would be the same one that I just had, which is, oh, no. If you hate them, then I haven't done a good enough job at helping you see how important they are, right? That's one thing.
That also reminds me of this idea that, you know, in all DBT therapists are on a consultation team. You have a chapter, the last chapter of your book is doing chains in consultation teams. And so I think that's a place where the therapists themselves can really kind of own doing the chains and doing them on themselves to try to avoid this idea that they're punishing or something that should be avoided.
Yeah, so I think one way in which we can communicate that to clients is to say, oh no, you don't like them? Let me tell you how valuable they are and actually how much they've helped me and how I've learned to love them, you know, or whatever our own personal stories are with that. I think that's really important. And there's a dialectical tension here because I have had clients and other people have probably had clients who have said something similar to, I thought about cutting last night, but then I realized we would have to do a chain on it in session and I didn't want to do that, so I didn't cut myself.
That's literally the definition of punishment by behaviorism. It's just the consequence that reduces a behavior, right?
Yes, right. And so
it sounds like a good thing, so help us understand.
It is. That's the tension. It is a good thing. And I would say that's wonderful for a client to have said that to me. And I need to see both perspectives because I don't want them to see it. I mean, on the one hand, I do want them to see it as so aversive that they'll do anything to avoid doing it when what that anything is actually engaging in effective behavior, right? It's kind of like
how very dialectical of you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like dialectical abstinence in DBT where we're saying, you know, we want you 100% to commit to not doing whatever X behavior is, right? 100% from this moment forward, we're asking you to commit to not doing this. And we're also going to track on the diary card whether you did it. And if you do it, we're going to, you know, do a chain analysis and figure out a solution. So we're both asking for 100% abstinence, and we're also saying, and when it occurs, this will happen, right? So it's kind of like that. I see that dialectical tension with chains also, because if somebody works to avoid chains by engaging in effective behavior, I'm all for it. On the other hand, I want them to love chains. Right. And I want to communicate that actually chains are not this evil, terrible thing. Ultimately, what I don't want is for someone to lie to me about their behavior because they don't want to do a chain analysis. Right. And
so,
just to add even more complexity to that before we get to lying, is that it is for many people an aversive experience to describe in excruciating detail the events that led up to behavior about which I feel regret or shame or anger or something. You know, that's a hard thing to do. And this is what happens in therapy in general, even across modalities and theories, is that therapy is when you go and talk about some of the most difficult things that are happening in your life. So so there is that quality to them as well.
You're making it so easy for me to help you because you brought it full circle to the rest of that complex question, shame. So what do you do when people feel intense shame about their behaviors, their thoughts, their feelings, their urges? How do you support them and how do you pull a chain out of them or get them to want to do the chain with you when they want to hide?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. And, you know, one answer that DBT would point you to would be to make sure that you are doing an ample amount of validation. And I say that in part because, you know, chain analysis as an assessment tool falls very clearly in the problem-solving camp of DBT, you know, the behavior change aspect. And we want to make sure that we're balancing problem-solving with validation. That doesn't mean, you know, as anyone who's done DBT training knows, it doesn't mean, you know, making a validating comment for every behavioral comment you make, but to make sure that there is sufficient validation so that the work of problem solving can occur. And that is true in chains as well. So I think validating the difficulty of the task, validating the emotions that the person is experiencing, validating the urges to avoid doing it, while also doing the cheerleading and highlighting the importance of this, and essentially communicating that this is the way through hell, right, is to do these really difficult tasks. So I think that that's a really important aspect to it. And, you know, I think that early on when I was, you know, starting out, I don't think I was as aware, perhaps, of how chronic shame responses can be. And I think I've gotten better over time, or at least more effective, I should say, in some ways of just assuming for some clients that there is shame there almost all the time. And if I can validate that and say, you know, here's our friend shame again coming to rear its ugly head and get in the way of us really understanding this problem, then the better able I am at getting them to collaborate with me about it.
And for our listeners, Shireen in her book does a really nice job illustrating how to do this dance and balance between validation with reciprocal communication on one hand and irreverence and change strategies on the other, and give some vignettes to illustrate that. So that brings us to your chapter on keeping the client engaged and you too. Mm-hmm. I really like the you too part, and I think we've been talking about that a lot throughout, and I appreciate you making that point for kind of making it interesting and engaging, stimulating, and maybe even fun for therapists. Do you have fun ever when you're doing change?
I do.
Awesome.
I mean, I think, you know, sometimes you're talking about really, I mean, you're obviously talking about really stressful, difficult things for a person. And yet, I think how I also see this is as kind of like being a scientist, you know, being a discoverer and really trying to understand something in a way that hasn't been previously understood by them or by other therapists that they've seen. And so for that, it becomes like a challenge for me that I find highly interesting. Yeah.
Anything other than what you've already mentioned on tips for keeping all of us engaged? You've already said a lot, but anything we missed?
Yeah, I think that this is where, you know, putting together, as you highlighted, some of the other essential DBT strategies, it's, you know, doing the stylistic strategies and using validation, using dialectical strategies when you get stuck and polarized on chains. Like, this is where, you know, therapists, I think, frequently feel overwhelmed by the sheer number of strategies that are in DBT, but recognizing within chains is that there's an opportunity to do all of those things, I think, can make it more interesting. You don't want it to be this dry conversation of, okay, then this happened, then what happened next, then what happened next, then what happened next. I mean, nobody wants to have a therapy session like that, probably. You want to see as a therapist in your mind's eye what happened that led to this target behavior. But that can happen in a number of different ways to get that information. And so I think you want to think about it as a DBT therapist. There's actually a lot of flexibility in doing chain analysis.
So in the same chapter on keeping everyone engaged, you write about dialectical strategies. Now, in this call, we've been talking about dialectics. You've been very dialectical in your approach to talking about these issues. And these are things you talk about using when the chain gets stuck. You give a really nice example of lots of different strategies from DBT, and I'm wondering if you could just share an example with us.
Yeah, so I think where people get stuck would be, or perhaps a clear example of people getting stuck as it relates to doing chain analysis is thinking about the strategy of chain analysis, is someone saying something like, you know, this happened, but I don't want to talk about it. And the therapist is coming at it from the stance of, we have to talk about it. this is the treatment. We have to talk about it.
We have to do a chain right now.
Yeah, like there's no question. The DBT manual says so, right? So we're immediately stuck here because the client's saying, nope, not going to do it. Then the therapist saying, like, we have to do it, and perhaps becoming increasingly panicked because in their mind this is the only way in which to go forward. So, you know, how do we incorporate dialectics here? You know, there's a whole list of dialectical strategies, and you could think about any one really as something to be integrated into this conversation, like making lemonade out of lemons. You know, I'm so happy that this happened this week, this terrible thing, whatever this terrible thing is. I'm so happy it happened this week because now we finally have an opportunity to talk about something that happened, you know, in real time where I can really understand it. So like, this terrible thing that happened to you is the best thing that happened to us in therapy. Or the more you don't want to talk about this, the more important it is to discuss. That would be more of like a paradoxical intervention where you might lead someone to think, what? What are you talking about? The more I don't want to talk about it, the more important it is.
I love that example, reading that in your book, because part of these dialectical strategies are to shake things up and get people unstuck. So it really grabs someone's attention, and it's very different from the message you were saying earlier of, well, we have to do a chain, or this is what's in the manual. It's also validating
right.
to the person.
Yeah, and also, you know, if I'm feeling like I don't want to talk about something and somebody were to say we have to because some manual says so, my, you know, oppositional self will say, F you, I'm not doing that. So so I think, you know, the dialectical strategies are really to get to a synthesis where you are working together, right, and figuring out. So another way in which you can get to that synthesis is to also validate and say, this is really painful. You know, it's really hard to talk about something that you wish just didn't happen, you know, and I can certainly understand the urge to avoid or just sweep it under the rug, because if I were you, I wouldn't want to talk about it either right now. And, you know, what we know is that when you don't talk about it, you actually don't solve the problem, which means there's a greater likelihood of you doing it again and falling into the shame spiral again. So as much as you don't want to talk about it, the only way we're going to have this go differently in the future, the only way we're going to get you out of hell is to really figure it out.
Speaking of getting out of hell, after writing about keeping people engaged, your next chapter talks about incorporating solutions into chains.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to share with us on that?
Yeah, one of the things that I think, you know, is a primary teaching point in DBT, and again, this was something that took me, I think, far too long to realize in my training, is that all DBT solutions fall into one of four categories. And the four categories are skills training, cognitive modification, exposure, and contingency management. And I think what I want to say about this is that the solutions, those four sets of solutions, actually map onto different areas of the chain. or different links in the chain. And so you want to think as a DBT therapist about all the potential solutions that are available to you, because I think what ends up happening for a lot of therapists is that we get stuck on our kind of go-to solution strategy. You know, maybe there are therapists who got trained primarily in cognitive strategies or cognitive restructuring, and those therapists always go after the links in the chain that were, you know, faulty interpretations by a client, let's say. But actually with a lot of clients, you know, that or a lot of situations, while those interpretations cause problems for them, those interpretations are not the controlling variable of the problem. And so there might be a more effective solution to offer.
Like, and spell out for our listeners, what's a controlling variable for people who may not know?
Yeah, so we would say that the controlling variable, so if we were to imagine a chain as being, you know, a set of links leading up to a target behavior as well as consequences, a controlling variable or variables are the links that we would say are kind of the most important in controlling the presence or absence of the target behavior. And so therefore, if we're going to have the most influence over changing the target behavior, going after the controlling variables might be the most relevant. So let me give an example. We might say that someone who engages in substance use, engaged in using marijuana, which is a target of treatment, on a Sunday night after they had gotten in a fight with a partner, and they had been feeling in intense physical pain all day because they have a chronic injury, and they got in a fight with a partner, and they started having all sorts of thoughts about the partner leaving them, and they thought, why bother? And they felt intense fear and loneliness, and they used marijuana, and they felt relief. Okay, so that's a meaning they felt a relief from that fear. Okay, the fear went down when they used marijuana. So that's a very quick snapshot of, you know, a series of events that led up to a target behavior, in this case, marijuana use. And so we would say, from a therapy point of view, we would say, okay, there were actually many things that happened that provide opportunity for solutions. Right. We might say it started with the person feeling chronic pain that day. And so we might say, okay, well, let's throw out solutions that will help the person feel less pain. Or we saw that they got in a fight with their partner. Okay, let's throw out solutions that we can reduce fights with partner. Or they felt they had thoughts like, why bother? Okay, let's throw out solutions that affect those thoughts. So, you know, every link provides an opportunity for solution generation. But if we were to think about it from a controlling variable point of view, we would say that not all links are equal. So for example, let's say this person actually is in chronic pain, you know, every day, all day, more or less. I mean, it changes a little bit, but not a ton. But they don't use marijuana every day. Then we might say the pain might have played a role, but the pain might not be the controlling variable there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I like how you said it.
Yeah.
I like you said it, not all links are equal. I think it's a really good way to remember that.
Right. Or we could also say, okay, well, maybe it was the, you know, the loneliness. But again, we might say, oh, well, this person experiences loneliness lots of times and doesn't use marijuana. So was it the fight? So as a therapist, what you might be doing is actually imaginally modifying these links. So in DBT, we would call this hypothesis testing, and we would say something like to the client, do you think if you hadn't been in so much pain that day and you still had a fight with your partner, would you have used marijuana? Right? We start modifying the links, imaginally speaking.
Uh-huh.
Or what about you were in pain and you got in a fight with your partner, but you didn't, you know, you weren't then left alone for a couple of hours, would you still use marijuana? So we ask these different questions to try to identify, as best we can tell, what were the most critical factors. and I might call those controlling variables for the problem.
And I like how you ask these questions in a way that's engaging for both parties, and it avoids that thing you were talking about, that boring approach of, well, what happened next, and then. It's a different, more rich approach.
Yeah, and I think it definitely keeps people engaged, and I think one of the things to recognize, of course, about this strategy is that you're both hypothesizing. Like, actually, you know, we don't know for sure. And a client might say that too. They might say, well, I don't know for sure, but I think that if I, you know, the pain really put me in a bad place and led to me using later. However, even if it's not 100% accurate because we can't know for sure, that still gives us a lot of really helpful information in terms of identifying what might be the most effective solution there. And so to bring this around to your question about the different solutions, is that doing that kind of questioning and arriving at, perhaps in this particular instance, the hypothesis that actually it was the pain that was a critical variable for using marijuana. What that would tell me is that in this moment, for this example, I might not stand to gain very much by addressing, say, the cognition, right? Instead, what might be, if I want to reduce the target behavior of marijuana, instead, what I might choose to implement first as a solution is pain management, and see if that leads to an effect of marijuana use. If it does, that's great. You know, we found the controlling variable and we addressed it and the marijuana use went down. If it doesn't work, this brings us back to what we were talking about earlier in the hour. If it doesn't work, then that means that what the client and I both believed to be the controlling variable might not be the controlling variable or might not be the only controlling variable. And so now we need to address other links in the chain.
So Shireen, in our last 5 minutes, I'm going to do a few rapid fire questions if that's okay.
Okay.
All right. First off, the title of your book is Pain Analysis in DBT. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say about non-DBT therapists doing chain analyses in general and being able to use the strategies in your book?
I would say non-DBT therapists who are cognitive behavioral or behaviorally trained will find this to fit probably very well with their treatment as it is. You know, maybe they need to learn more about it in order to understand how it could be implemented, but it is essentially a behavioral strategy for
assessment. People who are CBT therapists, not DBT therapists, do you think there's added value with them integrating the chain analysis approaches in your book to their work if they're not doing the full package DBT?
Probably, because what I would say is, you know, CBT therapists are trained to assess problems behaviorally. And, you know, Linehan was the first to describe this, you know, particular assessment strategy, which she called chain analysis. And so I think that there's certain value to learning about chain analysis, all the different components, and this idea of focusing on one specific instance of a behavior that might lead a CBT therapist to learn more about what it is they're treating in session.
Next rapid fire question.
Okay.
In your writing process for your first book, were there any times you had any problems show up that went against your commitment where you needed people to give you a chain or chain your own behavior?
You should talk to my editor friend who was very patient in waiting for this.
She said everybody should be doing chains.
Yes. I in my process of doing this, I would have to look back on the dates, but there was probably a good year or 9 months in which I was not working on this book. And in my mind, I have when I should have been working on this book. And so in my mind, there was a clear prompting event for what happened that led to me kind of not not engaging in writing behavior. And some of that involved, or addressing that, some of which involved just allowing some time to pass, because what had happened was a personal event that I kind of needed to process a little bit. But otherwise, I think from a behavioral perspective, what I learned I needed was very specifically stimulus control. I had to have writing time that nothing else could interfere with. And then I had to get lots of positive reinforcement. I mean, I live for praise and shout outs. So you need to have an editor who is willing to praise you for the teeniest, tiniest morsels you give her on a monthly basis.
Beautiful. And we've got 2 minutes left. I have problems of going over on things, and we committed to just the hour for today. So
thank you.
I have done change on this before, and so I set a timer for myself, and I'm going to end with one last question.
Okay.
So in your preface, you thank your acknowledgement for your group book, you thank your husband, your two boys, and your two cats. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done a chain on your cat?
I should. You know, cats are very unreliable narrators of their own behavior. So, however, I will say I have two young boys, five and seven. And now whenever somebody comes over to my house, my seven-year-old says, "My mother wrote a book." And he pulls out the book and he brings it over to them. But really what he's excited to show them is that one line that you just said.
Oh,
he just wants everyone to see that he is mentioned in the book.
Talk about positive reinforcement there. Well, listen, thank you, Shireen. This was phenomenal. I think that this is going to touch and affect DBT therapists, non-DBT therapists, and the many, many, many people who are working to help individuals and families with borderline personality disorder. So thank you so much for donating your time.
Thank you, Andrea, and thank you, NEABPD.
For all of you listening.
And thank you to both of you.
If you're interested in buying Shireen's book, it is available now. It just came out this past month. You can get it on Amazon or Guilford.com. And again, to all of you listening, thanks for joining in. Please tell your friends, tell your colleagues, tell your clients and families. You can access the recorded versions on iTunes, also on our website. And please consider supporting this program and other work from our not-for-profit organization, as these programs are offered free of charge. You can give a donation at www.neabpd.org. Thanks, everybody, and have a great night.
Thank you.